This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. The Non-Human Rights Project is a civil rights organization in the United States working to secure legally recognized fundamental rights for non-human animals such as apes, cetaceans, and elephants, in essence to secure their status as legal persons with the capacity for fundamental legal rights. Joining me now to explain all of this are Stephen Wise and Kevin Schneider. Steve is the founder and president, and Kevin is the executive director of the Non-Human Rights Project. Welcome, gentlemen. How are you today?
I'm excellent. Thank you for inviting us.
Great. Thank you for having us.
Lovely to see you. So welcome to KL. This is your first time here, I understand.
Yes, it is.
But, I mean, just for anyone who's unfamiliar, Stephen, you, I know you've been working on this, you know, this whole project of non-human rights, right, for animals for the last 30 years. How did you even get interested in a topic like this?
Actually, in 1980, I read a book by Peter Singer, the Australian philosopher, who talked about how non-human animals are treated and in what numbers they are exploited and killed. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that, and I was really shocked and realized that I was a part of it. Mm-hmm. And then I also noticed, as a young lawyer, that non-human animals did not seem to have any lawyers representing their interests. And since I had become a lawyer, because I was interested in issues of social justice and, you know, helping those who couldn't help themselves, I didn't see anyone who needed more legal help than the world of non-human animals. And so then I began working as an animal protection lawyer. Soon after that, within the next few years, I began to realize that it was very difficult. In fact, it was impossible to protect even the most fundamental rights or fundamental interests of any non-human animals, because of the fact that that they were legal things, which meant that they lacked the capacity for any kind of legal rights. And mm-hmm. as far as the law is concerned, they only existed on Earth, you know, for the use of us who are persons. And I decided the only way that that their most fundamental interests of any non-human animals could be protected would be if they became legal persons. And mm-hmm. so in 1985, actually 33 years ago, I decided that that's what I would spend the rest of my life doing and achieve. And the Non-Human Rights Project was born from that. And we're actually doing much better than I ever imagined we would.
And I know it was in the early 90s that you actually sued the New England Aquarium. I think it was on behalf of a dolphin?
Twice.
And you alleged that the aquarium was violating mammal protection law by sending the creature to Hawaii for training at a Navy center. And I know that the judge actually tossed out that suit, saying that the dolphin had no standing because it couldn't testify to any injury it might have suffered. And this, I understand, caused like a light bulb moment for you.
Well, I think the judge said it wasn't so much that the dolphin didn't have any injury, but that the Animal Legal Defense Fund, which I was at that point part of, that we hadn't sustained any injury, because that we see is the major problem with animal protection law, non-human animals are kind of out on the end, mm-hmm. on the edge of it, and the entities who are going to be injured are, you know, have to be human beings usually,
yeah.
And also the non-human animals are still seen as things, mm-hmm. and animal protection law really regulates the manner in which we non-humans actually exploit non-human animals. Sometimes
sure.
we might go over the line, and sometimes we don't, but the focus is always on the human interests, and that means that non-human animals are essentially treated the way human slaves were once treated.
Sure.
And we view non-human animals as slaves of human beings. Mm-hmm. And the only reason we understand that their fundamental interests can ever be protected is if they are persons. We also see that reflected in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, for example, that Article 6 says that everyone must be a person, or Article 16 of the United Nations Convention on Social and Political Rights guarantees that everyone will be a person. Mm-hmm. And the reason that they do that is because there's a recognition that unless you have personhood, you can't have rights, and therefore your fundamental interests can never be adequately protected.
Mm-hmm. And you know the phrase non-human animals, people don't understand that very well. Maybe Kevin, you know, we haven't spoken to you. Maybe you could explain that.
Sure. Well, as Steve has said, We're all animals, mm-hmm. but we're not talking about you.
Right.
So we're talking. It's a subtle or not so subtle reminder to people that yes, we too are part of the animal kingdom for religious, social, psychological, so many reasons why I think we often want to put ourselves on a pedestal and see ourselves as separate and apart, wholly different from the rest of creation. But that to me seemed like from a very young age to be completely wrong. And I think that as the world continues to develop, we run into things like climate change and deforestation, all kinds of issues that slowly, I think, are beginning to bring home the fact that this dichotomy, not only is it morally wrong, mm-hmm. we think, mm-hmm. but pragmatically speaking, it doesn't lead to good outcomes for the vast majority of people.
Mm-hmm. And when did you sort of get interested in this line of work? And when did you actually join Steve over here?
So I actually started, it's about 10, 12 years ago when I first got interested in these issues. I saw a slaughterhouse video that pushed me over the top and haven't eaten meat since. Mm-hmm. And it was at that moment that I think I really, it dawned on me, much like Steve, that this was a cause that I wanted to devote my life to. And so I did a lot of research, actually came across many of Steve's books, which were hugely inspirational in this. And it was then that I decided to go to law school. And so it was about 8 years. And then about 2.5 years ago, I took on the job as executive director.
It was a great decision. One of my best decisions I made was to bring Kevin on as executive director.
But look at that. You inspired his, you know, choice of career almost.
Well, I'm one of many. I mean, now it's funny. Even in my own time, when I started law school, it was beginning to be a recognized topic. But even in the last 5 years, it's been an explosion of interest in the United States, but also around the world. And I think that we play a big part in that, and I'm proud that we do.
Mm-hmm. And okay, and so talk to me about how Non-Human Rights Project, how that actually came to be formed, and you know, what are the sort of mechanisms that work within that?
Well, it was meant to be one of the ways that I figured we needed to move forward in order to be able to begin the struggle within the United States and then worldwide for mm-hmm. the actual personhood and legal rights of at least some non-human animals. And so part of that was, for example, beginning to get the legal profession itself to recognize that what we were doing was something that was important within the profession. Mm-hmm. So I began to write law review articles. I began to write books. I think I've written 22 law review articles. I've written 4 books. Yep. I began to try to teach at law schools. And the big breakthrough was in 2000 when I was asked to teach the first class in animal rights law at Harvard Law School. And then last year I was teaching at Stanford Law School and a bunch of law schools in between. And then the other thing is that I realized I couldn't do this myself and that there had to be an organization that would be formed with highly competent people who are ready to start filing lawsuits and litigate cases in a rational, you know, committed, smart way. And so that's when I formed what became named the Non-Human Rights Project.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, how would you describe your mission and your objectives and how do you carry out your work?
Our mission is to gain legal rights for non-human animals. And the way we do that is to try to understand what values and principles judges may use in various states within the United States. And then we frame our arguments in terms of what the judges already say that they believe in. For example, the values and principles that we have been adhering to in the United States over the last 5 years are basic things like, do you believe in liberty? They do. Do you believe in equality? Also, we noted that judges believe in autonomy, that they believe to a significant degree that their job is to protect the ability of human beings to act autonomously, to mm-hmm. be able to make choices and to be protected in the choices they make.
Yeah.
And so we go out then and find experts like Jane Goodall or others for chimpanzees or elephants or orcas, and we ask them and we read ourselves and whether they can testify that these non-human animals are autonomous beings. And when they can, and they have, we then bring them into our cases. We use them to show that indeed our clients are autonomous as well, even though they're not human beings. Mm-hmm. And then we then say, well, you believe in autonomy, you believe in liberty, you believe in equality. If you apply the values that you say you believe in to our non-human animal clients, then they should be protected. They should be persons, and they should have certain kinds of fundamental rights. And the one fundamental right we've been arguing for over the last 5 years is the right to bodily liberty that's protected by a writ of habeas corpus. Mm-hmm. Period.
And maybe you could explain that, you know, why the writ of habeas corpus is something that you use.
Well, Steve, and this was a real turning point, I think, in this movement in a lot of ways. It started like so many other things in the law by looking back. And Steve wrote a book called Though the Heavens May Fall, which recounts a very famous trial in the in England in the 1780s, where for the first time, in response to a habeas corpus petition, a very famous English judge, Lord Mansfield, actually declared for the first time that a human slave, an African slave who walked into a court as a thing, was transformed into a legal person. So we have this vehicle, this kind of path that we think and it's been used in other instances. It's been used on behalf of Native Americans in the United States, mm-hmm. who were at one point treated as things under the law and deprived of rights. And so with this path in front of us, again, as lawyers, we have to use the hooks that are out there. We have to hang our hat on the hooks that exist out there.
For sure.
And so this, we think, is an important one, but it's just the first foray. And, you know, when we go around the world, we talk to people. The vehicles and the specific mechanics may vary, but the heart and the essence of it, I think, is really the same, and one that people from any walk of life, any corner of the world, can almost intuitively grasp that we are not the only beings who value our lives, and it's past time for our laws to really reflect that.
To value our freedoms as well, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I'm speaking today to Stephen Wise and Kevin Schneider. They are both from the Non-Human Rights Project. Stephen is the founder and president, and Kevin is, of course, the executive director. And after this quick break, we'll find out some of the cases that they actually did argue out in court. You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. In the studio with me today are the very lovely gentlemen, Stephen Wise. He's the founder and president of the Non-Human Rights Project, and Kevin Schneider. He's the executive director of the Non-Human Rights Project. That is a civil rights organization based in the United States working to secure legally recognized fundamental rights for non-human animals such as apes, cetaceans, elephants, and the like. So we spoke about how you have taken the legal course, you know, to fight for this. Tell me about some of your clients, you know, some of the cases that have been argued on.
Well, we decided to begin in the state of New York on behalf of every chimpanzee we could find in the state of New York. Mm-hmm. Tommy, Kiko, Hercules, and Leo are the four chimpanzees that we began filing suit on behalf of in December of 2013. Mm-hmm. We've been in and out of many courts, at trial courts, appellate courts. We are still litigating right now. The High Court of the State of New York has a petition that we have filed asking for leave to appeal. I think the most interesting case as far as we've been concerned about was in 2015, a trial court in New York City did indeed issue the first writ of habeas corpus on behalf of a non-human animal in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. And that was a writ of habeas corpus issued on behalf of Hercules and Leo, who were two chimpanzees who were being imprisoned in a laboratory at Stony Brook University in New York. You can actually see, if you wish, some of the hearing that happened, because when you issue a writ of habeas corpus, and habeas corpus means you have the body, and so people who are being up until we started filing lawsuits, it was only people, but now a being who's being held against her will can be the object of a writ of habeas corpus that some other person files and says, Judge, this person's being held against her will. The judge issues a writ of habeas corpus, and the person who is holding the other person against her will is required to bring that person into court and give a legally sufficient reason why you can do that. And that's what Justice Jaffe did for the first time in history.
That's amazing.
And our work actually was the focus of a fairly famous documentary that premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2016 and was done by shot by D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hedges, who are two of the most well-respected, you know, filmmakers in the world. D.A. Pennybaker is actually one of the inventors of cinema verite. Mm-hmm. He's 93 years old, and he's the only documentary filmmaker ever to win an Academy Award for Lifetime Achievement.
Yeah.
And so they were following us for 4 years. They probably shot 400 hours of film to turn into a 90-minute HBO BBC documentary. And one of the scenes there is because they're allowed to get their cameras into the courtroom, is you can watch, you know, for the first time as the judge has issued a writ of habeas corpus, and you know how she's trying to deal with the question, how she grapples with it, as to whether our chimpanzee clients, you know, should have, should be ordered free because they have a right to bodily liberty. So we've been working on chimpanzee cases. We also, a few months ago, filed a lawsuit on behalf of three elephants, Beulah, Minnie, and Karen in Connecticut, who are being exploited and imprisoned by a traveling circus in the state of Connecticut. And we're in the middle of litigating that case. We're looking now at cases in California, elephants, chimpanzees, orcas who are being held prisoner at SeaWorld. And we are also, you know, moving out throughout the world. That's why we're here in Kuala Lumpur, and as well as, you know, India or Sweden or Finland. I don't even know how many countries we're working in right now. I think around 13, where we speak to them about what sort of non-human animals they may be able to use for clients and what courts and what kind of litigation they might do.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, when you are presenting these cases, so you had one judge who kind of, came on your side. But
yes.
I imagine that you must have faced a lot of, criticism, a lot of people who did not agree with, you know, the arguments that you were making.
We have, actually. And look at those very carefully. I think it's fair to say that in the first few years of litigation, we have run into judges who've never seen what we've done before. This is the first time they've ever been confronted with this. They've not been prepared for it.
Yeah.
And frankly, they don't understand what we're talking about. They don't understand our arguments. And we have not yet seen a case in which we lost, in which we felt they actually understood what we were doing. They might say something like, which we consider to be ridiculously simplistic, like, well, they lose because they aren't humans. And what we try to explain to them, which we would think they'd understand, is that so many judges seem to think that being a person and being human are synonyms, that all persons are humans and all humans are persons.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't understand legal history, that at one time, millions and millions of humans were things, were not persons, you know, slaves or women or indigenous peoples, Chinese people in the United States in the 19th century. And perhaps even more instructively, there are and have been and will always be all sorts of entities who are not human, who are persons, you know, corporations or ships or the country of Malaysia. And perhaps even more importantly, courts around the world are beginning to apply this kind of personhood idea to both non-human animals. There has now been a chimpanzee named Cecilia who was held to be a non-human person, and a writ of habeas corpus was issued on her behalf.
Yep.
But there's also, 3 or 4 weeks ago, the Supreme Court of Colombia held that the Amazon rainforest was a person. In New Zealand, they've said that a river is a person. A national park is a person. In India, the holy books of the Sikh religion has been said to be a person, or a mosque is a person, or a Hindu idol. So what we try to explain to the judges, and with only limited success sometimes, is that being a person is not a biological or taxonomic category. What happens, those who are persons as opposed to those who are things is an issue of public policy and, you know, what's important, what values and principles are important, what are your moral principles, and that what we are trying to do with sometimes greater, sometimes lesser success is encourage judges to get rid of the false idea that somehow only humans can be persons and begin to weigh the arguments we make from liberty, from equality, from public policy, from morality. And it's slowly happening, but it's taken some judges a bit longer than others.
I can't imagine.
And I find it striking that, you know, of all the reactions we get, I think one common thread is the judges never come out and say that we're bad or that we have the wrong idea. In fact, they sometimes say we're laudable, we deserve praise, but they don't really have, we think, yet the kind of moral strength to make the right decision. They'll say things like, go to the legislature. This is an issue for the political process, which, you know, in the future, we are branching into that as well, but that does not let them off the hook. And we won't let them off the hook, and we'll keep pushing until, you know, the judges in the U.S. finally start to, we think, join this wider global trend of really expanding who counts under the law.
Mm-hmm. Some of the judges have actually, on the record, said that, what great arguments you made, but I'm not going to be the first one to do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we understand that, and
sure.
We're looking for judges who have the moral courage to be the first one to do what is right, mm-hmm. and what is legal, and what's moral.
But, you know, despite the fact that no court has any has not really granted any animal personhood, you are, I think—
Only in the United States.
Only in the
they
United
have
States.
Outside,
yeah,
yes.
Sorry, only in the United mm-hmm. States. But, I mean, even within the United States, I think you are quite convinced that, you know, people's feelings are changing and that you are seeing changes. You know, for example, there's no more captive breeding of orcas in SeaWorld and things like that. I mean, are you seeing more and more positive sort of results from the work that you guys are doing?
Well, I could even speak more directly. Earlier this year, we commissioned a first-of-its-kind nationally representative poll, opinion poll in the United States, and it was about 1,200 or so applicants, enough to, you know, form a nationally representative sample of every demographic. And what we found is that with minimal, you know, public opinion work or public kind of pressure work done on our behalf, a majority of people in the United States already agree with what we're talking about here, that
sure.
great apes, orcas, whales at least should have this fundamental right to bodily liberty. So I think that, you know, there's a lot more support than people often think. And even more to the point, when you go in and you ask the question in a very specific way, it's one thing to say, do you believe in animal rights? It's very broad. It doesn't really kind of tell you what you're getting at. But when you start saying, do you believe in chimpanzee rights? Do you believe in orca rights? Do you believe in elephant rights? And you're really bombarding them with all of the science that's out there that says, you know, definitively that there is so much more going on inside of them, inside of their minds, than we ever really have understood.
You know, the data that we have been polling, we think is likely correct. You see in the film, mm-hmm. Unlocking the Cage, at the end where we see a Gallup poll that comes out in which 30% of Americans say that animals should have the same rights as human beings. That's 40% of women and 20% of men. I don't think Kevin and I think that non-human animals should have the same rights as human beings. In fact, we don't. We don't.
Right.
We don't think they should vote. We don't think they should have an education. We don't think they can marry my sister. You know, but we think that there are certain kinds of fundamental rights that protect their fundamental interests that they should have. And when we start presenting such questions as, you know, should chimpanzees have certain rights? Should orcas have certain rights? It wouldn't surprise us that it would move up from 30 or 40% into 50 or 50+%. And we think that judges are way behind, you know, the people of the United States. And I think they need to begin to understand that they're going to be judged by what they're doing, you know, right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to get the judges to think about the issue of, do they want to be seen as the judges who upheld slavery in the 19th century or would not give women rights in the 19th century or did not give indigenous people rights in the 19th and 20th century, or do they want to be seen as those who did the right thing at the right time?
Yeah. And you do work a lot with the scientific community. And I think, you know, scientific evidence of non-human animals' cognitive and emotional complexity is very vital to your lawsuits.
Indeed it is. We work with all of the greatest chimpanzee cognition researchers, all of the greatest elephant researchers. And I think I'll let Kevin talk about what he thinks about chimpanzees, but when and why they're so extraordinarily cognitively complex. And by the way, anyone who sees the film will watch what chimpanzees are doing, and they'll be absolutely astounded. One of the things with respect to elephants that always struck me is one of our experts named Joyce Poole, who spent 30, 40 years working with elephants, talks about the fact that when a group of elephants come to a place where they need to make a decision, that they discuss with each other what they're going to do. And she uses the word discuss. And I asked her, I said, do you mean to use the word discuss? She says, yes, I do mean to use the word discuss. So we're talking about beings who are so incredibly cognitively complex that they engage in group discussions in order to reach a decision. And I'll let Kevin talk about some of the things about chimpanzees that caused him to come to the same conclusion.
Well, yeah, and I don't even think it's really unique to chimpanzees. But when I first realized, or it dawned on me, that chimpanzees could learn and use sign language, could even teach it to each other without human intervention, that was a real eye-opener for me. Another thing that you see, if you offer two chimpanzees an unequal reward for the same task, the one who's getting the weaker reward will reject it. And in some instances, the other who is getting the greater reward will, out of some seeming sense of solidarity, reject their reward as well. So this, you know, there's just reams and reams of stuff. And I think that for so long, you know, animals do know how to communicate with us, non-human animals. It's just that we have, by and large, failed to learn how to listen to them. And I think, you know, ultimately that's clearly to our own detriment. You know, this isn't just about restricting human behavior, telling people what they can and cannot do. This is about, you know, ensuring that autonomy and these values that we really do claim to cherish are allowed to flourish in this world to the greatest extent possible, because why else are we here?
Yeah. I think it is important for us to stress that there isn't anything touchy-feely about what we do, that everything that we do is based upon reams of scientific evidence.
Yeah.
I think our chimpanzee affidavits were about 150 pages long and cited to more than 500 scientific articles. And interestingly, in the 5 years in which we have been litigating on behalf of both elephants and behalf of chimpanzees, not a single fact that we have ever produced to court has been contradicted.
Okay. And I think, you know, just as logical human beings, if you see an animal who's being held captive, and there's plenty of, you know, videos. We just went down a wormhole, my husband and I, yesterday, of YouTube videos of animals in captivity banging themselves against glasses because they were going crazy. Surely that's enough evidence for anyone to know that they should not be kept in these glass cages. Like, I'm talking about zoos or anywhere, you know?
You know, times, I think, often blind us to what is really right. I mean, yeah, we have this regrettable capacity, I think, to abide by injustice. Mm-hmm. And you see it all the time. You ask, what would I do if I was in the Holocaust? Or what would I do if I was in this situation? And so many of us, we just like to say, of course I would do the right thing. It's really easy to divorce and ignore all the social pressures, the implicit, the unconscious biases that we all have. And so, you know, that's why we have to really attack this scientifically and really – you know, really get into the details.
It's not just we would recognize that. I mean, we have a long history, for example, of human slavery, where it was clear that they were just like us, but that did not seem to stop us from enslaving them. There had to be an overlay of changing values as to what simply is morally right and wrong, and then what ought to be legally right and wrong.
Yeah. And how do you guys work on the ground in that sense? You know, trying to change people's mindsets, trying to get them on board with the idea that, you know, they deserve, that animals deserve, well, not all the same rights, but, you know, they deserve to be recognized as,
well,
with these rights.
Within the courtrooms, we base our arguments on the values and principles that the judges themselves say that they believe in. We make no bones about it that we're attempting to push them into a corner in which they have to do one of two things. They either have to agree that their values and principles that we say they hold, they do hold, and at that point they need to rule in our favor.
Sure.
Or they can say that we misunderstood what their values and principles are, so they don't have to rule in our favor. Or what's happening a fair amount is they simply arbitrarily say things like, well, they aren't human. But what that does is, but when you say an autonomous being, you know, it doesn't, it can be a slave for her whole life just because she's not human. Mm-hmm. What we remind them is that we've been there before, that many humans were seen as slaves. Why? In the United States, black people, the judges said, well, the reason you can enslave them is they aren't white. Well, what did that have to do with anything? Or the reason that women have been treated in a certain way is because they're not men. Well, what does that have to do with anyway? Or the reason indigenous peoples were treated that way was because they weren't not indigenous. Well, you know, what does that have to do with anything? Mm-hmm. So just simply pointing out a difference like they're human, we try to tell the judges, we've been there before. Where you just simply point out an arbitrary difference, what we're saying is that that is both morally and legally, historically, politically wrong. And it's an error that humans and judges and legislatures have made again and again and again. And why don't we not make it one more time?
But do you think society is actually ready? I mean, it's quite a radical notion, you know, animal personhood. Do you think society as a whole, we're actually ready?
Yes, I do. And I think our polling shows certainly within the United States, as I and Kevin, you know, travel the world, we see that people are ready and they're ready to go out and fight, you know, and struggle in rational ways, backed up by science that uses the values and principles that the legal system say they believe in. Because when judges make arbitrary distinctions and deprive autonomous beings, for example, of their rights, we understand that they're undermining the rational basis for human rights, and we think that those sorts of decisions are inherently unstable, mm-hmm. and that they will fall of their own weight. It just means that people like us and others, we simply have to never get discouraged, and we never are, and we just keep pushing and pushing and pushing until they do what they themselves, you know, think they ought to do.
Mm-hmm. Like any good civil rights movement.
we are a civil rights movement, as yeah. I think you said at the beginning, you yeah. know, we define ourselves as a civil rights organization, mm-hmm. that focuses on achieving legal rights for non-human animals.
So to anyone listening, you know, how can they sort of get involved in this whole thing?
Well, from a simple level of taking these ideas seriously and talking with one's friends about them, or organizing an event to, say, show our film, or spread the word that, you know, this – it's time to really seriously you know, take this issue on. And as we move forward, you know, the tasks that are available become more substantial if we're looking at passing legislation, or if we are, you know, traveling the world recruiting lawyers who might want to take this fight up on their own. But as we always try to continue to expand not only our work, but also the base of people who can be involved. You know, only so many people can kind of sit in a room with us and write these legal papers and at a time, and that's okay. But we really want to, as much as we can, find ways to make this a broader movement, because
sure.
we do, looking at history, thinking about it logically, we know that that's a vital part of it. But I think that what we're doing, these specialized lawsuits in rather narrow circumstances, captive species, great apes, whales, dolphins, elephants. They're not native to the United States. You know, you get to kind of sidestep a lot of the larger issues, say, for instance, in parts of the world where elephants and humans conflict and sometimes
yeah.
are chasing the same resources, right? But what we're doing is creating this framework that we think over time will is a necessary backbone for, you know, development that actually respects the rights of animals. And, you know, just having a right doesn't win you the whole day, right?
No,
we all have
that.
Rights, but it gets you into court. It gets you into a forum where you can at least have that fight and you can achieve a more harmonious balance. Because right now it's, are you a human? You have rights. If you're not a human, you don't. And, you know, that's simply wrong.
People can run for office. They should vote for political parties that support having legal rights for at least some non-human animals.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is not necessarily about cruelty to the animals. This is just a fundamental right to not be held captive.
Well, that's just just the beginning. And mm-hmm. by the way, our arguments around autonomy, we don't argue that only autonomous animals should have rights or personhood. We simply say that autonomy is a sufficient condition. That if you are autonomous, you should have certain kinds of rights. But we don't argue that only autonomous beings could. And we're also arguing right now on behalf of bodily liberty for captive animals. But we don't believe that bodily liberty is the only rights that they should have, and that it should only apply to captive animals. You have to start somewhere, and that's where we're starting. It's already been exploding, really. And also, lawyers and others in different countries may choose to emphasize different animals or different rights or different causes of action than we do. On one end, there is, you know, a horrible, horrible situation of tens of billions of non-human animals are brutalized and exploited and killed and tortured every year. On the other hand, the only way to protect their fundamental interests is for them to be persons with certain kinds of rights. And what goes in the middle, how you move from one to the other, you know, will change from country to country. And we're here to simply help in any way we can.
Okay. All right. And I guess another way to kind of, you know, get ourselves more educated about it is to watch Unlocking the Cage. And how can we get our hands on this film?
Well, it's available on HBO. Okay. It streams on HBO. But also, folks can go to our website, nonhumanrights.org. They can get in touch with us. We're very easy to find. We're on Facebook. We're all over the place. We're on every social media. And reach out to us. We're happy to provide the film so that you can arrange a screening and really, like I said, help spread the word. And there's also Steve's TED Talk, if you want to have a more condensed version of this, highly recommended, 14 minutes long. And it really conveys, you know, the essence of what we're talking about here in a nice, you know, compact, shareable form.
I think it's also available on iTunes.
The film, that's right, yep.
The film is okay.
The film is indeed, and I never know if it's available on Netflix or Amazon or not, but I know it's on iTunes. I know it's on HBO.
Okay, and your four books, one of them, Rattling the Cage, Towards Legal Rights for Animals, all these books available on Amazon as well?
They are all available on Amazon, and one of them actually is in Chinese. We've only become really interested in working with Chinese language speakers over the last year, so we're trying to get that kicked back into gear so that sure. Chinese language speakers can read that. But they are available right now in English, French, and Spanish, and if we can find the Chinese again in Chinese as well.
Okay, all right, and you guys are going to be traveling around the region some more.
Yeah, after this, we're off to Delhi. And then we're off to Bangalore, the National Law School there, to give talks and do some events, meet friends, lawyers, activists, judges. There's really a lot of interest in people who want to take up this fight.
We came from Hong Kong. Before then, I had just spent a week in Barcelona. Before then, a week going up and down Israel, speaking at all the law schools. Before then, I was in London and Cambridge University. You know, I'll be in Berlin, Portugal, you know, in Finland, Sweden. We are in great demand, and we're delighted to go anywhere in the world to help anyone, you know, who wants to try to achieve legal personhood for non-human animals in their jurisdiction.
Okay. All right. And if you had to leave us with just one last message, what would that be?
The only way in which a non-human animal's interests are going to be protected is if they have legal rights. That's it. All human history has said that. And what's true for humans is true for non-humans as well.
Anything you'd like to add, Kevin?
Yeah, and I've seen this firsthand. It's much like myself. You got to get them while they're young. And I've seen firsthand children, young people, they kind of intuitively get this stuff. They get that there's something really wrong with depriving any animal of her freedom. And so any chance we get, we try to package our arguments in a way that can be, you know, grasped by young folks, but also to meet with them, to speak to them. See a lot of value in that.
Mm-hmm. And as we saw in Colombia, it was actually the kids who actually got this whole thing passed.
That's right. This is actually part of a really exciting growing trend all around the world, including the United States and federal court, where children below the voting age are bringing lawsuits claiming that, you know, the status quo driving climate change, deforestation, all of these things is really doing a grievous legal harm to them. It's depriving them of a chance at a decent life. And so I think that it's vital that that we have children in this fight because, you know, they're the ones who are going to bear the brunt of these impacts if we don't really change the way that we categorize and look at the world and how we give rights.
Get them young.
That's right.
So if you'd like to get in touch with both Kevin and Stephen, you can head to their website, which is nonhumanrights.org. And like we said, you can even watch the film. It's available on iTunes. You can get any of Steve's books. So many resources out there. You know, get informed and, you know, find out how you can be part of this. And if you missed any part of this interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, which is available on Google Play and the App Store. Thank you again, gentlemen, for joining me today.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
This has been Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.